This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What I've tried to do with the history of coal is to show that this has always been a very dirty, a very dangerous, a very deadly fuel.
In the 1970s, coal fueled over half of the U.S. electric grid. Today, that number has dipped below 10%. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with journalist and author Bob Wiss, whose new book, Black Gold, The Rise, Reign, and Fall of American Coal, provides an important retelling of the history of coal in this country. We look at the market forces that shaped coal's rise, its devastating impact on the environment and human health, and talk about the ludicrous but dangerous attempts by the current administration to prop up coal, even as it's on life support. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bob Wiss. He is a journalist and an author, and his new book is entitled Black Gold, The Rise, Reign, and Fall of American Coal. Bob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So this is a story that's been unfolding for many years, as we've seen over the last couple of decades, coal really plummet in terms of its production and usage around the planet, but it's not a problem that has gone away by any means. And my guess is that you started it before the re-election of Donald Trump, which does not bode well for those who care about the dangers of coal. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of shocked that I expected coal to continue to die. And I'm shocked 6 months into the Trump administration where suddenly coal is a hot issue again, something he wants to resurrect and bring back, like the horse and buggy.
Why don't you give us the genesis of this project, and when did you decide you were going to write this book, and how has that changed as events on the ground have shifted?
This goes back a number of years. I was teaching, and I've always done environmental stories, and I'm especially intrigued with environmental history. And I'd understood that the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, back like almost 80 years ago now, had done an investigation into an environmental issue. It was like the first time anybody won a Pulitzer Prize for an environmental issue. So I wanted to know what that was all about. And it turned out that St. Louis had this terrible, terrible air pollution problem that had been going on for years. And it got so bad that on one particular day, a Tuesday in November, something called Black Tuesday, the smoke was so bad, the pollution was so bad, you couldn't see more than 3 or 4 feet. That's how bad it was. And it was all from coal. It was from burning coal, not just from industry, but think of the tens of thousands of chimneys that each winter, to have people keep warm, would burn coal. And it had been going on for years in St. Louis. Well, that was a little bit of a shock. I didn't really realize this was going on. Not only was it going on in St. Louis, it was going on in other cities all across the country, and it had been happening ever since, from like 1870, 1880 on. So I kind of dived into the story and was fascinated by it, and had this really neat story about St. Louis and how they solved their air pollution problem, because they did. They had this huge newspaper campaign run by both the reporting side and by the editorial side, and they convinced the city to buy cleaner coal. And it really did clean up the problem. Of course, it was more expensive, which is the same issue we have today. You can solve the problem, but you got to spend money. And that's one of the problems we have. So I finished that, and I really couldn't quite sell that story. So I started just looking into coal. And from there, it just evolved into the book we have today. That book with the coal was so dominant in the 19th century that it helped build the American Empire. But it is dangerous, it is deadly, and it's always been environmentally dangerous, and it's really killing the planet now. So that's the gist of how the whole thing started.
And you do a really good job of going back and giving a historical account in this country of how coal. I always thought of black gold as oil from the Beverly Hillbillies theme, right? It's like Texas tea, black gold. We always think of the money that could be made in the oil industry, and some of the largest fortunes in the world has ever known sprung from those 19th century oil barons. But the coal barons were a very real thing as well, and they were in lockstep with the railroads, as you spell out. The distribution of coal was one of the critical parts of building these monopolies and fortunes around the country. And today, still, railroads are spending a lot of their resources shipping coal around the country. This is kind of an antiquated method, obviously, but the money is still there for the railroads. Why don't you talk about that link between the railroads and coal and how that alliance has shaped American energy policy and business over the last 150 years?
It's almost what comes first, a chicken and egg situation where you can't really hardly figure out if coal started the railroads or the railroads started coal, because without coal, the railroads obviously couldn't fire the locomotives. And as you point out, the coal was literally the main payload for the coal companies. And really, there were connections between who owned the coal companies and who owned the railroads. And on top of that, the other main area that tied into it was steel. I mean, coal wound up firing the mills, which created the steel, and the railroads would carry both the coal and the steel. But we needed the steel for the tracks, okay? I mean, until steel developed, and steel only developed after coal became the primary fuel source, we were using wooden rails. Well, wooden rails lasted 5 to 10 years, and they were incredibly, incredibly dangerous. So the railroads never would have developed. The coal wouldn't have developed as much as it did without steel. And you can go back and find companies that have names that have coal, railroad, and steel attached to them. And in the book, I actually had a list of about 20 companies like that, where the combinations were so close that they would just merge together. So and of course, it was fascinating. I had no idea that kind of historical situation had occurred. And it just shows you just the power of coal and how it transformed the country.
I'm just a poor coal loader. I'm digging deep down in the mine. I'm just a poor coal loader, digging deep down in the mine. With the heart I work for my woman, she treats me so unkind. I'm getting tired of working, boys, I believe I've got a hunch. I'm getting tired of working, boys, I believe I've got a hunch. But I have to go into those mines with cornbread in my lunch.
I don't have a map in front of me, but even if we look on today's railroad maps, so much of it is rooted in coal mining and where those payloads are delivered. I mean, Wyoming shouldn't have as many railroads going to it if you go by population, but obviously it's a big coal state. So what are the takeaways that you had in terms of learning about this as it unfolded for you, as you were studying this history, in terms of history repeating itself and the power that coal companies had in trying to control the message that this was a clean fuel?
Well, as much as I talk about railroads and steel and things like that, and coal, because I talked about the coal miners, and there's great stories about the coal miners and the hardships they endured. The thing I kept coming back to was this story, which had started from the very beginning, the air pollution thing. And I will say that I had more frustration doing my reporting on talking about this issue of how the communities suffered from this air pollution. That was probably the greatest challenge I had. And I would do research in cities like Pittsburgh, which was notorious for the air pollution from both steel and from the coal that was there. And other places, smaller places like Chattanooga, which had steep river valleys and things like that. That was the problem also in St. Louis. And I could never, ever really, I wanted one story in one community, one fight to really feature it. And I had difficulty. And I'll tell you why I had difficulty. The problem is that there were advocates out there, activists, who fought this air pollution. They fought the coal companies, they fought the steel companies, and even the railroads, which created a significant amount of air pollution when the trains came in chugging, producing all this smoke. And the problem was that the advocates were women. Okay, now think about it. Think between 1880, particularly to 1920, when they finally got the vote. These women, they were often club women and high society women, married to powerful men. But they didn't really, when it came down to it, to a political fight, to an economic fight, they just did not have a whole lot of power. And they would lose time and again. And but I couldn't find good detailed records of what happened, because history had faded and history had not even recognized that these were important things.
So were some of these women set aside by newspapers because they were, like, let's say, Mrs. Robert Johnson or whoever? They were not necessarily considered people.
That's absolutely correct. They were appendages to their husband. And they really, I mean, you know, they could advocate as much as they want to. And they were talking about things from a domestic standpoint, about how this was affecting their children, how it was affecting the cleanliness of their houses, how they had to do extra laundry and things like that, which, you know, who cares? We got to have jobs out there. And of course, there was, and the medical industry, the medical profession was developing and showing that air pollution was a problem. Doctors could do autopsies of people who died in urban settings and showed that the lungs were shriveled, but it just wasn't enough and it wasn't powerful enough. So ultimately, I just happened to stumble upon the fact that Salt Lake City, of all places, also had an air pollution problem. You wouldn't think Salt Lake City would have a problem, but if you think about it, and you think about those high mountains on each side of the city and how it's in a deep valley.
Kind of like Denver. I know Denver had some of the worst smog in the country 20 years ago.
It gets trapped, particularly on winter days, this inversion layer. So, and that had been going on for years. And there were several fights, but I found one involving a woman named Corrine Adams, who was heading the Salt Lake City Ladies Literary Club. And in 1913 and 1914, Corrine Adams announced that the club, instead of dealing with Shakespeare or other issues, would actually take on the air pollution issue in Salt Lake City. And they fought hard for an ordinance to get it. And so while I was doing my research, I knew Corrine Adams had to be gone. I mean, this was 1913, 1914, but I started doing genealogical research to see if I could find any ancestors of Corrine Adams to see if they had any remembrance of this fight. And one thing led to another. I realized she'd only had one child, and apparently that one child had died. So she didn't have any offsprings. It would be difficult. But somehow I came across a death certificate of the son, 16-year-old son, who died in 1910. And the death certificate, the internet's amazing with genealogical research. I found the death certificate, and the death certificate said that he died of TB. And it was like a chill went up, because TB, air pollution is not going to cause TB, okay? But it can certainly exacerbate respiratory illnesses. And suddenly I realized, I knew why she was so motivated. And it just totally, totally changed the story. And I suddenly realized I had a story. Now, she never, ever publicly talked about this, but clearly this is what had driven her. And it probably inspired other women. And just like all the other cases, they eventually got the city to adopt an ordinance, $10 fine for anybody who's violating this extreme smoke thing. And within a few years, the city was totally ignoring the ordinance, and it failed. And it was just another example of how women had no power. But it made a powerful story.
So, Bob, in your title, it says The Fall of Coal. As we mentioned in the outset, with the Trump administration, it's trying to make a little bit of a comeback here. I remember having a conversation with a friend who is in the financial space maybe 20 years ago, and he said, Alex, the future is coal. We have 300 years worth of coal still in the ground, and that's where the smart money is going still. He was not really worried about the environmental devastation of it. But from a market standpoint, we saw that he was wrong on many counts. It wasn't just an environmental issue. It was also financial. You mentioned how in Salt Lake City, they were able to take measures to clean up the air. The Chinese have pivoted quite a lot over the last decade plus and tried to embrace the green revolution in a way that the world has never seen. They've really ramped up their renewable portfolio. How has the Chinese consumption of coal affected the overall market and shaped the American production in turn? We're not exporting the kind of numbers we used to, are we?
Well, Trump wants to export a lot more. The odds of doing that are not very good. You know, we have export facilities on the East Coast in various places, but there have been efforts to try and build export facilities on the West Coast, and they just haven't survived at all. You know, the Chinese have just a totally different model than we do. And fortunately, we've been able to recognize that the generating plants have just, because of our demand that they become cleaner and cleaner, there's only 23 coal-fired plants left in the United States. And even though Trump would like to keep all 23 alive, plus build more, the cost of building new generation is so much more expensive than any other form, including wind or solar, that it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. And it doesn't appear that export is also, that's the other area that he wants to increase his exports. But I have a chapter in the book about how there was a fight here in Longview, Washington, near where I live, where they tried to build a fairly significant facility that would send coal to China, India, and places like that, and it failed. We talk about railroads and the tide of the railroads. One of the biggest things that people were most upset about was the long train loads that go through cities and disrupt traffic. And it was so great that that was one of the biggest issues. It would seem to be a bigger issue almost than climate change and the concept of the morality of shipping something that is creating such havoc in the environment, that we shouldn't be doing it. That seemed to be less important than the long train loads that tie up cities.
Put a smile on everybody's face. I'm gonna kneel and pray every day, lest I should become vain along the way. I'm just an old chunk of coal now, Lord, but I'm gonna be a diamond someday.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Bob Wiss. He's a journalist and author of the book Black Gold, The Rise, Reign, and Fall of American Coal. So, Bob, maybe you can give us also a snapshot of how the power dynamic in the Senate has shaped the continuation of this seemingly insane coal policy over the last 20, 30 years with a very narrow margin in the Senate over the last three, four decades. West Virginia has been kind of the epicenter of the coal fight, and Joe Manchin has been this swing vote. He was a blue dog Democrat for many, many years, and now he's been replaced by one of the richest men, a coal baron, Jim Justice. Jim Justice is now has taken Joe Manchin's seat, and this man is just as bullish about coal as anybody in the country, I imagine. So how big an impact did Joe Manchin's swing vote have on continuing coal over the last 10, 20 years and keeping these coal-powered plants pumping, in your estimation?
Well, I think Joe Manchin clearly had a huge impact, primarily because he was a Democrat. I mean, almost all of the support is on the Republican side, as opposed to the Democratic side. And if you think of the Democratic side, the first senator you think of is Sheldon Whitehouse, who has campaigned extensively against not just coal, but extensively about the concern about climate change. The other thing that's interesting is it really is quite fascinating that West Virginia has such a stronghold on our public attention when we think of coal. You know, we often think of coal because of Appalachia, Kentucky, West Virginia. And it was for many, many years the key place. Although if you want to go back far enough in my history, Pennsylvania had an outsized role. But what we don't realize today is, as you mentioned, Wyoming. The Wyoming-Montana area actually produces more coal. The West produces more coal west of the Mississippi than the East does east of the Mississippi. And that is often overlooked. But it also explains perhaps why Republicans are so much in control, particularly in the Rocky Mountains and the plains and things like that, too.
I'm just looking at a chart here that shows from 2010 to 2023, just over a 13-year period, the amount of coal mining employment went from 21,000 to 14,000. We're talking 14,000 jobs. It really is a myth, isn't it? That dates back to the first part of the 20th century.
If you look back in the 1920s, there were over 800,000 coal miners, okay? If you look back in the 1930s, there were like over 600,000 union coal miners. Now, besides those numbers that you just rattled off, the number of union coal miners is like one out of six, whatever that number was. I think it was 14,000. So yeah, I mean, the impacts are significant, and it just shows how much coal continues to be, while it's a threat, and it would be a threat if we revived it, how it has declined so significantly, and why are we spending so much time to revive something that is really heading towards what appears to be a natural death.
Just to put into context what you had said earlier, you had mentioned how there are only 23 active coal plants in the US. At its height, what were we looking at in terms of coal plants?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it today, there's 23 coal plants left, and there were 290 that closed in a 10-year period. Let's put it this way. Coal was back by the 70s and the 80s. Coal was producing for more than 50% of all the generating of electricity there was, okay? You compare that to the other options were oil, gas, or hydro, because really solar and wind were just not options in those days. And it's fallen to less than 10% now, and it just continues to fall. So the decline has been rapid, and the decline has been profound, and the reasons are obvious. I zeroed in on a particular plant that was operating in Arizona, which was built because there was a huge fight where people wanted to dam the Grand Canyon, of all things, to produce electricity, and that failed. Instead, they built a coal plant. Well, the coal plant created so much air pollution in the Grand Canyon, you couldn't see from one side to the other. That's an example of the power of coal, or the deteriorating effects that coal will have on the environment. And that plant eventually was closed and torn down just a few years ago.
So, Bob, now that it looks like we're in a post-coal future, hopefully, why should we still care about the history of it?
We really need to understand not just the science about what's happening with climate change, but we need to understand the history of how it developed. And what I've tried to do with the history of coal is to show that this has always been a very dirty, a very dangerous, a very deadly fuel. And while we tolerated it and it helped build the American empire we have today, it also is just something that has just gone, and we need to lose it and never see coal again. Leave it in the ground. We may have 200 more years of it, but we don't need it. We need to protect the planet.
The book is Black Gold: The Rise, Reign, and Fall of American Coal by Bob Wyss. Bob, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Galactic, Brownie McGee, and John Anderson.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.